This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. It's so nice to see such a full house here. My name is Casey Andrews, and I am an associate professor in the English department, and I also coordinate our speakers and artists series here. I'd like to start by just asking you to please silence all noisemakers at this point, anything that might inadvertently beep and embarrass you. As part of the English Endowed Reading Series and Whitworth Speakers and Artists tonight, we have the pleasure of hearing from Padraig O'Tuma. Padraig is with us tonight as a poet and a storyteller, but he is a man of many talents. I first met Padraig in the summer of 2012 when I was in Northern Ireland with a Lilly seminar that was studying peace and reconciliation. Padraig was the group's facilitator, and he did this masterful job of deftly yet firmly managing sessions with 15 overly talkative American academics, and he kept us all in line so wonderfully. He taught us so many things about peace and about Irish history, and also some fashion advice. We were told that you can spot an American man in Europe by their unfortunate choice of blue jeans and white socks. I feel now embarrassed every time I put my son in that outfit. Padraig has been active in the peace process in Northern Ireland, leading groups through the kind of therapy and healing that's needed after decades of violence. He's been an advocate and a witness for LGBT rights and is especially eloquent on matters of sexuality and Christian faith. And among his musical accomplishments is an album of Christian lament called Hymns to Swear By. Being with Padraig in Northern Ireland, it seemed that there was not a single professor, peace worker, paramilitary, or poet in Ireland whom he did not know. Once when I asked him if he'd heard of this obscure Irish pop star that I happened to like, he admitted that he not only knew him, he wrote songs for him. Padraig has published two poetry collections, Readings from the Book of Exile and Sorry for Your Troubles, both available for purchase in the back here. He's been a teacher to me and to many others. At church one Sunday in Ballycastle, a parishioner asked the group of us what we were doing in Northern Ireland, and when we said we were at Corrymeela, she said, "Oh, you're a do-gooder then." And I don't know about us, but I can certainly say that Padraig is a do-gooder. He is someone who makes the world a little more peaceful, a little more humane, and a little more aware of God and the language of creation. Please welcome with me Padraig O'Tuma.
It's a real joy to be with you. Thank you for that warm welcome, and thank you for the warm words, Casey. We just came from one of the local places here. We had a bite to eat, and I wasn't entirely sure what to order. And when the woman who works there came around and asked me, she said, "What did I want?" And I said, "Is there something on the menu that I wouldn't be able to get anywhere else? I'm from overseas, and what should I have?" And she said, "Well, the fish and chips are pretty good." And I said, "I'm Irish." And she went, "Oh." And she didn't really know what to do then. So I had the pulled pork sandwich, which was pretty good. So it is a real joy to be here. I am thrilled to be in a place where people take faith seriously and people take engagement with the world seriously. And it has been very enjoyable today to meet a few of you already. And I am going to be involved a small bit tomorrow morning with a creative writing class. And it's a real pleasure to get to know some of you by name, some of your stories, and some of your choice of words. And it would be nice, perhaps, at some point, if we could have a question and answer. Is that okay? Because it would be interesting to hear what you have to say and what you have to ask. I don't know how much you know about the island of Ireland. We have two jurisdictions on the island of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland came into being in 1922. The Republic of Ireland has a nationalist, mostly Catholic, Irish identifying with our own flag identity. Northern Ireland, as it is known, has a contested identity. Some people call it Northern Ireland, and they would often fly the British flag and call themselves British. And they would say that they don't live in Ireland, and they would tend to be Protestant. Catholic people who live there would fly the Irish flag and call themselves Irish, and they wouldn't call it Northern Ireland, they'd call it the North of Ireland. Tiny little syntactical difference, but a wealth of meaning, an absolute wealth of meaning. And so there is no shared narrative about where we are, about whether people like me, who come from the South and live in the North, are foreigners or locals. There is no shared understanding about how to refer to the past. From 1968 to 1998, 3,300 people died, and up to 500,000 people were either injured or directly affected by grief. That's one out of every three. Our population in that tiny little corner is 1.5 million, roughly. So one out of every three people was directly affected either by injury, trauma, or bereavement. That's a monumental collective experience of trauma for which to have no shared narrative. Claire Mitchell, who's a friend and a senior sociologist, has coined it elegantly when she says, in Northern Ireland, we have a meta-conflict because there's conflict about what the conflict's about. So there's no beginning point. Some people say it was all grand till 1968 when those troublesome Republicans started their campaign of terrorism. Other people say it was all grand until 1607 when those English people decided that they were going to colonize us, and then the 1800s when they made our language illegal. So depending as to where you start, the story begins and ends or not in different places. How to tell the present depends on how you understand the past. And how you understand the past will greatly inform how you hope for the future. And so into that mess, there is a whole peace industry that seeks, in the midst of an unshared narrative, to create spaces of storytelling where people whose lives have been hugely affected by grief can come together and share narratives with each other and talk about what does it mean to share space with each other, whatever we call the jurisdiction, whatever flag we fly, however we understand each other as local or foreign to each other. And that, in a certain sense, is a gift, because there is so much that is not certain in the world, and so many borders around the world are artificial. So many identities are incomplete. Identity shares the same word as identical, and I'm not identical to myself. And you are not identical to each other. So it is a gift to live in a place that has an uncertain relationship with certainty, because it allows us to think, well, surely be to God, our human relationships and our capacity for community must be based on something other than certainty. Can it be based on something much more fluid, much more like a cord held together in tension, and a cord tuned beautifully to hold itself together wisely? So I offer you some poems tonight that are reflections on hearing people's story of trauma, of grief, of being a theologian in the midst of a place that has been wounded and bloodied and murdered by the incapacity of theology to reckon with its own morality and the consequences of its own bad use of words. I'll start off with a poem called The Opposite of Fear. I moved to Belfast 10 years ago in Belfast, we have 42 ironically named peace walls. They're around 50 feet high. They used to be so high, but they've gotten higher and higher. And now there's barbed wire on top of them. And we have more now, 15 years after our peace agreement, than there were during our peace agreement. A new one went up last week, but it's supposedly a new funky one because it's removable. You can just put it up when you need it. I don't know if that's success or pathology. So for 6 years, I lived right by a peace wall. And my first day living by the peace wall, I looked out the back wall. It was in a Catholic area. I looked out the back wall, and there, back window of my house, and there was a small boy standing on my back wall, wrapped in an Irish flag, so he could look over the peace wall. And he was singing a little song to the Protestants on the other side. Do you know the song, What Shall We Do with the Drunken Sailor? Yeah? Okay. You need to know that song for this. The Opposite of Fear. There is a small boy standing, singing on a wall, and his song says, burn, 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 ye bastards, burn, 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 ye bastards, burn, 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 ye bastards, early in the morning. When I was a small boy, I used to wonder what to do with all those drunken sailors, because there were so many of them. And when I found that long boats don't make sober sailors, I searched out new tactics to silence them. Cowering, singing other songs, long walks. I even put myself in a long boat and sailed to the Pacific. But they know how to follow. Who has taught us to fear, my little man? You in your 4-foot frame carry lusty barricades against those on the other side of our barbed wire peace line, those you do not dare to care for. because, oh, what songs would you be left with then? And me, I thought I'd perfected all my sailing and my singing, but the distance is getting shorter now. I am a Protestant on the falls and a Catholic on the shankle of my own fear. So may we learn to love. I got to know that little boy, and his beginning point was a proper introduction to the complexity of his life. He was great fun. We had the period from 1968 to 1998 is called the Troubles. And often people have thought that's a very diminutive little word, the Troubles. It sounds like, oh, you know, a spot of bother. But in the Irish language, Gaelic is what some people from this country sometimes call the Irish language. Gaelic is an umbrella term that encompasses the language spoken, the Gaelic language spoken in Scotland, the Isle of Man, and Ireland. So when I speak about Irish, I'm meaning what you might call Gaelic. But Gaelic is a broader term than just the language spoken in Ireland. In the Irish language, tribloid is the word for bereavement. So when we talk about the Troubles, we're talking about the bereavements. And that doesn't necessarily make it the perfect word. There is no perfect word for when a bomb explodes and blows somebody apart. So I'll call it whatever anybody wants. The war, the conflict, the Troubles, I don't care. If somebody's life has been ripped apart, I'll call it what they needed to be called. So officially, the Troubles finished 15 years ago in terms of active conflict. And last summer, I was sitting at a conference, not too long after Casey had left. And sitting at a conference, there's a bunch of people sitting around, and there was a peace man, a well-known, authoritative peace man who has done some remarkable work. And he's in his early 60s. And there was a young man in his early 20s. And the young man said something about the Troubles. And the peace man said, "You're too young to know about the Troubles." And so here's a little poem called Not Yet. "You're too young to know about the Troubles," the peace man said. And the young man said, "Father shot dead. Mother fell apart. Brother fell into himself. Other brother sent to live with others. And me, I smothered everything. I was farmed around. And now, years later, we have found ourselves back beneath a shared and troubled ceiling." Not yet. No one's too young to know about the Troubles. The ideological distance from active political conflict doesn't stop for families whose lives has been ripped apart. As I said, different people call the region, the jurisdiction in the north of Ireland, different things. If you're Catholic, you tend to call it the north of Ireland. If you're Protestant, you tend to call it Northern Ireland. And that is a complicated thing. You can identify yourself by whatever you call the place we are. And so here's a poem which is designed deliberately to annoy everybody, called The Northern of Ireland. Any of you who've studied foreign languages will know the glorious joy of learning off how to conjugate a verb. In French, je suis, tu es, il est, nous sommes, vous sommes, il est. Okay? I speak Irish, English, and French, and so much of my primary and secondary school years were learning how to conjugate verbs in different languages. So there's a play on the conjugation of a verb in this. The Northern of Ireland. It is both a dignity and a difficulty to live between these names, perceiving politics in the syntax of the state. And at the end of the day, the reality is that whether we change or whether we stay the same, these questions will remain. Who are we to be with one another? And how are we to be with one another? And what to do with all those memories of all those funerals? And what about those present whose past was blasted far beyond their future? I wake, you wake, she wakes, he wakes, they wake. We wake and take this troubled beauty forward. One of the things that I think is particularly important in terms of reflecting on an area that has national conflict like that is how much you learn about being human when you have to navigate language on every single day. Linguistics and syntax are not just the area that people with a particular interest in poetry or linguistics or literature or language study. Everybody has to, in a certain sense, be a mediator of their own language. And that is a sophisticated, reciprocal, intuitive art. Because you have to think, who do I think this person is in order for me to use language that's going to make my message come across? And that changes all the time. There's an active and fruitful engagement between people who took up arms and who fought in security services and people who were bereaved in the context of Northern Ireland, together with people from Israel and Palestine who have entirely different politics and ideological and religious identities in terms of what does it mean to look at the identities and nationalities and independences that are there or possibly there. And so one time I was in poet in residence for a group of Irish people, paramilitaries, police people, people who'd been bereaved, people who'd killed people, and some Israelis and Palestinians who came from across the entire spectrum of religious identity and political points of view. And our job was to stay in the same room with each other for 3 days and to find ways to talk. And it's much more difficult to stay in the same room and say difficult things than it is to leave and slam the door. That's reasonably easy. To leave and slam the door. Remarkably satisfying, utterly unfruitful. And what I love about poetry in Ireland is that poetry has a lot to say about how do we hold these spaces together where we are not trying to define a single language that we must all therefore adopt and colonize ourselves into something, but somehow we find ways to talk to and about each other. What I noticed is that a lot of people in the room referred to their childhood and lessons they learned in their childhood growing up in a place of conflict. Protestant children in Northern Ireland, the police were considered legitimate targets. So therefore, every single policeman to this day checks underneath their car when they leave for work as to whether there's a bomb underneath it. And there's been a couple of bombs in the last couple of months that have been found and disarmed. And last year there was a bomb that wasn't found, and God rest him, this guy died. Nobody told anybody if you were in the police. You never left in your uniform. And children of police were taught how to lie. And then in other communities, children of paramilitaries were taught never, ever answer the door. Never. Never answer the door. Because you never know who's behind it. And in the room, there were people who were considered to be legitimate targets because they were children of people with certain political identities. And in the room, there were people who said, I never murdered anybody. I just took the life of legitimate targets. And then somebody said, well, I guess I was a legitimate target then, wasn't I? Because I was 8 with a gun held to my head. So here's a poem called The Pedagogy of Conflict that goes through 3 lessons of learning from childhood in an area of conflict. When I was a child, I learned to lie. When I was a child, I learned that sometimes lives are protected by an undetected light lie of deception. When I was a child, I learned to lie. And now I am more than 25 and I'm alive because I've lied and I am lying still. Sometimes it's the only way of living. When I was a child, I learned that I could stay alive by obeying certain rules. Let your anger cool before you blossom bruises on your brother's shoulder. Always show your manners at the table. Always keep the rules and never question. Never mention certain things to certain people. Never doubt the reasons behind legitimate aggression. If you compromise or humanize, you must still even out the score and never open up the door. Never open up the door. Never, never, never open up the blasted door. When I was a child, I learned that I could stay alive by obeying certain rules. Never open up the door. When I was a child, I learned to count to 5. 1, 2, 3, four, five. But these days, I've been counting lives. So I count one life, one life, one life, one life, one life. Because each time is the first time that that life has been taken. Legitimate target has 16 letters and one long, abominable space between two dehumanizing words. The poem from which most of these ones about the troubles have come, the book from which the poem is called Sorry for Your Troubles, which is a phrase that we say in Irish when somebody's been bereaved. We say, Ní maílim do hriblóid, which can be translated as sorry for, or I don't like, or I'm not glad about your bereavement. We have another phrase, Is ulclum do rish, which means I ache, I horror for your breaking. We have another phrase, Covron chri, which means shared sorrow of the heart. And you can learn a lot about the phrases that we have a lot of things for. And in Ireland, we've got a lot of phrases for grief, which kind of indicates that we're a sorry bunch of people, really. I performed the poem when I was a child. I learned to lie at the book launch, and a friend of mine brought his four-year-old along, and he's been trying to teach his four-year-old not to lie, because the four-year-old is a precocious child with a remarkable creativity of syntax and imagination. And so the four-year-old was sitting at the back, and I started off going, when I was a child, I learned to lie. And I heard echoing back at me, he learned to lie? And my friend left shortly afterwards with his four-year-old. So rather than depress you for the whole evening, I suppose I want to speak about the context of community. What does it mean to be community? And there's an Irish phrase that is very meaningful to me. Erská chéile warás na dhéanamh. It is in the shelter of each other that the people live. It is in the shelter of each other that the people live. It's a beautiful phrase. The word shelter, ská, in Irish, can also mean shadow. And I suppose the first section of poems that I've just finished are poems in reflection of the pathological shadow that we can cast on each other. I want to think about ská as shelter now for a while. A number of years ago, when I'd moved back to Dublin, I was living in a flat. I had lived overseas for 5 years. I moved back to Dublin, and I was living in a flat and used to go into a poetry night in Dublin, in Dublin city centre, and loved it. It was a wonderful, wonderful night. And one time, there was a couple living in the flat below me, Dominic and Jenny, and they had two beautiful twin boys who were just about a year old, and they had adopted me, the twin boys. I think they decided this fella needs a little bit of kindness in his life. So these small humans decided that they would orbit my life in a way that was a wonderful gift, and I adore them. So I invited their mum, Jenny, out to the poetry night one night, and husband looked after the kids, and Jenny came back afterwards and said, this is incredible. People were reading poems about the war. People were reading poems about their sex lives. People were reading poems about religion, about school, about Irishness. And her husband, Dominic, just got a little bit nervous. And he said, Jenny, you need to promise me that you will never, ever write a poem about our sex life. And so I'd like to read you a poem called Dominic and Jenny's Sex Life. I decided there and then, immediately, there was going to be a poem called this, but I didn't really know what I was going to do about it. Initially, I thought I'd have a bit of a laugh. And then I saw them dancing at a party, and something happened. And this poem, I'd say, took 5 minutes to write. It was about 6 months in the brewing and the percolating, but 5 minutes to write. And it's dedicated with great love to them, really. I did actually have some raw material, unfortunately, from which I could draw, because my bedroom, we were in flats, my bedroom was above their bedroom, and many's a night I turned on BBC radio, loud enough, really. But that doesn't enter into it. Any of you with delicate sensibilities can rest easy. So, Dominic and Jenny's sex life. I saw them dancing and I ceased to wonder. The thunder of his broadened shoulders and her fine head held high, defiant, caring and carefree. She is his racing Pegasus and he her circling eagle. If they were strangers, their pulse would draw them inward. Were they asunder? Oh, I am sure that their thunder and their lightning would bring about a holy storm, a rain-me-down storm, a flood the earth with water and float upon the ark of our own love storm. And they went in, these two by two, and they came out with these two more. They have two boys, two toys, two joys of their existence, each other of their own choosing, but these boys of their own making. Each owns the other, and the other knows his own. And they have recklessly demanded and received the fruit of all attention. Oh, I watched them dancing and I stopped to ponder. The fonder than I grew of this couple's funky groove, with rhythm in his tender boots and she exulting in the life that she is loving, the love that she is living. Oh, I give you all my rage and my affection, my love and resurrection dreams. I fling my hands up in the air. I have no cares upon me now. I dance around your body, and we are made here in this place, born again to our own world, hurled upon this dance floor center stage, because we are wounded and we are walking and we are woken to the beat of our own force. They own their earth. They know their walls. They scale their walls. They shape their clay. I saw them dancing and I ceased to wonder. They were mortified. Well, actually, Dominic was mortified the first time I read that out loud. Jenny was delighted. And each time that I perform it, I send her a message to say that people have heard about their sex lives. And she goes, oh yeah. She's particularly happy. Now, Robert Frost said, in order to be universal, we must be parochial. And Elizabeth Bowen said, to turn from everything to one face is to find oneself face to face with everything. And what I love about the process of literature, about any writing that does it well, is that we can find in the small parish of an individual so much of what it means to be human, so much of the tension, the grief, the hope, the sadness, the possibility and the limitation about what it means to be human. And my mother is a particular teacher to me of that. My mum goes to a prayer group where they say the rosary every Wednesday night. It's around 12 people in a room. If you took, see that table over there? If you had around four of those tables, just that's around the size of the room. And in the room, there's a fire in the grate, and there's an electric radiator plugged in, and there's a gas radiator also lit. So it's a little bit like a mixture of the rosary and Bikram yoga and a seance and a charismatic prayer meeting all in the same place. So around 12 or 13 people inside there. So inevitably, my mother falls asleep. Around the second glorious mystery. She wakes up around the fifth glorious mystery, which is the last one. So the first time I went along with her, we were driving back in the car afterwards, and I said to her, did you have a nice sleep? And she goes, I wasn't asleep at all now, Padraig. All right. We could all hear you snoring. And she went, that's not sleeping. That's a holy sleep. This is 100% the truth. And I said, that's asleep, Mum, like you were snoring. And she goes, when you fall asleep during prayer, it's not asleep, it's a gift. And I was like, you're deluded. And she goes, but you wake up feeling very relaxed. I was like, yeah, it's a snooze, you know. And so I went home. This was gold to a poet. Like, this is fantastic. I went home thinking, I'm going to write the funniest poem about my mother. And I got writing about it, and then I started to think about how tiring life is and how good it is to have a group of people and also a relationship to faith that says, I'm tired and I can welcome a sleep and wake up without deepening my tiredness and anxiety by thinking, oh, damn, I fell asleep and I shouldn't have. Life is tiring, and when life has been full of grief, as it has for many people, it is a good thing to find a space amongst friends and amongst the friend that we have in God to welcome rest. So here's a poem about that. At my mother's prayer group on a Wednesday night, some of the women fall asleep from bead to bead, from time to time, from prayer to prayer. They call it a holy sleep, thus sanctifying their little dozes. Even the fire respects those sacred snoozes, settling down comfortably to the business of glowing gently, strongly, silently. 12 warm bodies in a cozy firelit den near the harbour and the old circus site. A holy sleep that brings supernatural rest and renewal, a kind of coma into which you slip mid-prayer and emerge post-trauma, spiritually nurtured to the gentle rhythm of clicking rosaries, intoned voices, centuries prayers. There are silent presences watching those asleep and those awake, hearing all those needs you daren't pray aloud for fear of clicking cups on saucers a coffee morning later. They are watching those we love and those we hate to leave and hearing all those prayers voiced again, just like last Wednesday, for healing and a hope to find a kindly face. And the sacred thing about this sleep is that it is thus called, thus loved, thus recognized and welcomed like a snooze on Hoth's soft heather on a hot, sunny September afternoon by 12 lonely souls who were looking toward the table and the chat and the biscuits waiting on the pressed white cloth and hoping that their fire will burn more bright. The Irish word for lonely is uignach, and it builds on the Irish word for grave, uig. And what I think is interesting about it is that, in a certain sense, the linguistic structure of that anticipates that to feel lonely is, in a certain sense, to begin to face the context of your own death. And it isn't done like that in a morbid way, because there is a truth that the only person who can die for you is you. And so there's something to be learnt in loneliness. To have an aggressive relationship with your own loneliness is possibly to add to the kind of tiredness. And I imagine that all community, and the best kind of community, can be built with people who recognize their own loneliness and don't see people as somebody else to be the antidote to their loneliness, but somebody who accompanies them in loneliness. So I have a poem called L is for Loneliness. Did anybody watch The Neverending Story when you were small? Let me see your hands. There's a small shout out to The Neverending Story in this. And it's not Atreyu! Or The Luck Dragon. L is for lonely. L is for lonely because that's what I've been. O is for ordinary, because these days it seems to me loneliness is ordinary, and ordinary is fine, and ordinary is going to be here for a while. N is for the nothing, and the nothing is not lonely. The lonely is just ordinary, but the nothing is void. Lonely I can deal with, the ordinary is fine, but the nothing really scares me with its deep, vacant eyes. E is for everyone, because everyone's a little I. Everyone's a little lonely, a little happy, a little shy. Everyone's an anyone, and anyone could be me. The poor and the persecuted, the pure and the sleek. L is for licking the wound where I inscribed on my own skin with my blood ink, the yearning I can't hide. And Y is for yonder. And yonder is not here, and right here is yonder to someone who's not here. And yonder rhymes with wander, and wander rhymes with love, and all love is a little lonely, made with ordinary stuff. I want to go back to some stories about the troubles in the north of Ireland. So there's a whole variety of people in the peace industry who create symposia and human communities where individuals from diametrically opposed political, religious and national narratives come together to share with each other, not to colonize each other into some kind of shared sense of, oh, we all agree now, or we agree to disagree, because I mean, agree to disagree is a pretty poor standard to set. Really, it's to say we disagree well with each other. We've made fruit from our disagreement. We've learned to understand, and then to, from the position of understanding, go, I still disagree. That's a really interesting thing to do. I use the word peace less often. I use the word reconciliation less often. I tend to say to people, I will help you have a bloody good argument. And to do that, there are certain rules. Stay in the room. Hold the gaze of an individual who represents the thing that you think you must hate. Listen to them. Learn to hear them speak for their own self. Learn to recognize their first-person narrative and use words for them where they will recognize themselves in the words you use for them, rather than using your words about them where they will not recognize their names. These are human endeavors, but they are remarkably fun and fruitful, utterly engaging and transferable to a whole host of political, ideological, and theological differences that can cause real damage to individuals. And so there's a really interesting practice in Northern Ireland, bringing people together who disagree. And in 1981, 10 men died because they went on hunger strike. All prisoners who were arrested in the context of the conflict had been arrested as political prisoners. So when they were put in jail, they could organize their own timetable, they could wear their own clothing, and they were considered political prisoners as opposed to criminals. And Margaret Thatcher, towards the end of the 70s, began to remove that. And so what the political prisoners did is they removed their clothing. They went around naked or they had blankets around their shoulders. They were called the blanket men. They smeared their feces on the wall as both an artistic and a human protest at what they felt was fundamental corruption. And then when that wasn't gaining enough attention, there was a whole series of them on two-week blocks went on hunger strikes. The absolute majority of them were Catholic men who were fighting for the Republican cause. There were some Protestant men who were fighting for the Loyalist cause who also went on hunger strike. And it was like dynamite in the community. It split the community. And I know that Pam was there very shortly afterwards. And so you'll be able to hear from an eyewitness account some of the dynamics of that. It's 30 years now since that happened, and it's still an emotive thing. The hunger strikers had a flag that was a black flag. They had five demands that they were saying, you know, we want political status and we want to be able to wear our own garb and be in charge of our own timetable and be in terms of visitors, etc. And that was denied. And in 1981, 10 of them died, the first of them being Bobby Sands, who was a poet. And in the days before Twitter, the way to alert a community, because television would go off at around midnight, the way to alert a community was that people would take the bin lids and bang it on the ground. And so people, the night that Bobby Sands woke up, people woke up to the sound of bin lids banging on the ground, and they went out and started to do it, all Catholic people alerting that they knew that we'd bang the bin lids when Bobby Sands died. And I heard from Protestant people that they woke up from the neighborhood right nearby and just heard this and were petrified. There's something very primal about the sound of tin on earth. Clanging through streets. And so this incredible group of Catholic and Protestant women got together to think about how do we talk about the hunger strikes, despite the fact that some of them knew men who died and some of them knew men who were or were married to men who had been part of the security services who were imprisoning those who ended up dying. And the women found a rhetoric of connection that was remarkable. And it was from a feminist point of view, what they did is that they looked at the question of political hunger strikes through the point of view of the body, and particularly the birthed body. And it was a nun who led them in that. And I loved it that it was a nun who had never had the experience of birthing a body, who was the one who said, what is it like to birth a body? And what is it like to imagine that body annihilating itself through starvation? So here's a poem called Hunger Strikers. On my grave, it'll say, he gave long introductions. So. Hunger strikers. And there was banging on the bins that night, and many frightened people woke and noted down the hour. The clock of hunger strikers dead is not ignored with ease. And then, please God, please keep loved ones safe, was then repeated round and round and round, like rosaries told upon a bead or shoes upon the ground of orange marching. The five demands, the five-year plan that saw a blanket round a man, the dirty protest, Thatcher stance that gave a new and startling glance at just how deep a people's fury goes. And God knows each single mother's son was sick of hunger. All those younger faces became stripped and old, with eyes shrunk back and foreheads cold and bone, skin that's limp and paper thin, barely separating blood and bone from stone. And some did say, enough is now enough. And others said, never, never will a martyr die. He'll smile upon us long from Muriel's wall. And others said, what nation is this? We're abandoned on our own. All this for clothes to warm some dying bones. And some said, that's a traitor's talk. And others bowed their heads and thought that they would hate to go that way. And then Bobby Sands was dead, and there was banging on the bin lids on the falls. It echoed through to Shankill Gospel Halls, and there was trouble on the street that night, and black flags started hanging while people started ganging up. Black flags marking out the borders of belonging, the thin black barricade that's been around for 30 years and stayed a fragile point up till today, and cries of how 10 mothers' sons all starved and died when all they ate was hope and pride. Earlier on, there was an interview with some of the people from the English department, and somebody was asking about, as we were chatting in advance, about does it feel like an agenda to have to write poetry with an agenda for peace? And partly, I suppose, all poetry has an agenda. To pretend it doesn't is to deceive oneself. So it's just perhaps about being slightly more upfront about a stated agenda. But one of the joys of writing poetry, where in some ways you're curating conversations that arrive at you, is the ability to have right in front of you points of view that you can choose to move into and move out of, to blend together, to create irony by blending two points of view. And in one group, there was two villages in Northern Ireland, where two villages, rural villages, about 2 miles in between them, one predominantly Catholic, one predominantly Protestant, and there had been some murder between the two of them. And it was a murder of a girl that I call the shot-faced Juliet, because she was a Catholic girl who was going out with a Protestant boy, and a member of a relative of the Protestant boy shot the Catholic girl dead while she was in bed with her boyfriend. And it traumatized two villages, and they didn't know how to talk. And I was part of a 6-month extended process where we brought representatives of the village together. And in that group, there was a woman who's blind. And it was often her point of view that I took. And she was a fascinating woman. She very deliberately used the word, the way I see the troubles is. And she initially used to poke fun at people, saying, I love the word see. And people didn't know what to do with that. Like, you know, very careful about language. And she was deliberately pushing back. She had adopted 2 Kenyan boys. And she one time described how curious it was to not understand the concept of skin color. Being a blind woman with 2 blind Kenyan boys, being aware that people outside of her point of view saw that as controversial. And she thought that was bewildering. And she thought that people were lacking something. And she described that initially when she was working in Belfast during the Troubles, she was staying in a hostel for young professionals. And the woman who ran the hostel used to follow the blind woman to the train each day just to make sure she got there. She was a remarkably independent woman. She needed no accompaniment and no kind of silent guardian angel. She didn't know this happened until much later. And she was telling us, and she was going, it was utterly unnecessary. She knew exactly where she was going. She was very confident around Belfast. But she said, but isn't it true for all of us that we need somebody to watch us? And so here's a poem called, And Isn't It True for All of Us? And isn't it true for all of us that we need someone to watch us when we leave, and when we need to make our own way home? And when we're making something we can't see, or when we're shaping up to be a person that can feel 100 sorrows and still get through the day, who could dream 100 horrors and make it anyway? And isn't it true for all of us that we need a guiding other, maybe mother, maybe lover, maybe nothing other than a stranger who could see our fear and with kindness then unfold a welcome? And isn't it true for all of us that we need our secrets told, and without another to bear witness to the children that were never born and would never be a grown-up, we would be alone and lost and cold. There would be childish hungers left inside of us needing to grow old. wonder if we'll take a few questions now. I've got a few more poems to say, but why don't we take a few questions now? You can take a breather and stop listening to the Irish voice. Casey, do you want to moderate questions? Grand. Okay. So does anybody have a question? And don't embarrass me by making me stand up here like an idiot alone. Okay. Yeah, rhythm and sound in poetry, and whether that's representative of an Irish linguistic tradition. Like many European countries, Germany and Italy and Ireland, there are dialects within each place. We might refer to one language like there is German, but really there are Germans and anybody, you know, German languages, and anybody who studies German will know the difference between Schwäbisch and Hochdeutsch, or you know the different languages between. The Italian spoke in Naples and then standard Italian. And in Ireland, we have dialects also. And I come from the dialect that particularly places a lot of emphasis on the vowels. Other people laugh at us, but our dialect places a lot of emphasis on vowels and a very, very high emphasis on diphthong. Because our language has, Irish only has 18 letters, so there's a lot of composite sounds that are made by the combination of letters that make no sense to if you're only looking at it with English linguistics in mind. But to an Irish linguistic eye, I can read Irish and Scots Gaelic because they share very, very similar linguistic structures and linguistic ways of referencing and making sounds. So the dialect that I speak does tend to be very strong on the ahs and the oohs and the a and the oi and all that. And it makes for some people who do some good impressions of people from my area in terms of how we talk. So there's an Irish language cultural centre in Belfast, and the Belfast people call it Cultulin. But I call it Cultúrlin, and they think it's hilarious. But I am very aware that the way that I recite poetry in English draws on the cadences of the Irish that I grew up speaking in school and bits at home, and then also the Irish poetry that we learned to recite in school. So, yeah. Other questions? Okay, so do I have a favourite poet? Having mentioned Robert Frost and poets I like to read, I have a variety of favourite poets. My favourite dead Irish poet is Patrick Kavanagh. He died in the 70s. There's a remarkable book called No Earthly Soil that's put together by a man called Tom Stack, which is the publication of Patrick Kavanagh's poems that reflect on religion, which is two-thirds of his poems and makes some reference to religion. And the introduction, Tom Stack is a priest in the Dublin Diocese, and the introduction is remarkably elegant because it refuses to say Patrick Kavanagh fits into this particular way of theology. It says, no, here's the integrity of his own way of looking at the world. And he's incredible, absolutely incredible, Patrick Kavanagh is. He's got two poems in memory of my mother. And one of the poems, he was very close to his mother. The poem starts, it's called In Memory of My Mother, and it says, you will have the front gate open, the door ajar, the kettle boiling. You will know I am coming, though I send no word. It's beautiful, just this gorgeous image of heaven through the hospitality of his mother who will welcome him. Incredible. Sinead Morrissey is Belfast's current poet laureate. She's incredible. Really, really wonderful performer of her own work and quite fiercely inquisitive about human dynamics. She grew up a communist in a communist family in Belfast, so she's deliciously outside the narratives of Catholic and Protestant. She's like, I have no clue, I'm just a communist. This is when she was eight. I am a big fan of the contemporary American poets that I know of. So Mary Oliver is a sacrament in writing. Julia Kastorf, who I know is coming, is an incredible writer. I'm reading her book, Poetry in America, at the moment, and there's so many stories about poems about cars in it. And I think it's a wonderful reckoning on a poetic level with the vehicle which is a very important thing in the United States, where space is so vast and where buses go nowhere. Meg Carney is incredible. She's got two collections, Home by Now and The Unkindness of Ravens. I think the first was written in Manhattan and the second in New Hampshire, where she moved after 9/11. And it's a remarkable public witness to a poetic reading of post 9/11, not direct on, but just as a side salting of some of the poems in Home by Now. It's really incredible. Mary Howes, the Poet Laureate of New York City, I don't know, and she's astonishing. Christian Wiman, I can only read him in bits because it hurts. He's so good. I just recently bought 3 books of Jane Kenyon, and I know a number of her books. She's got a beautiful poem called The Suitor. She's talking about sitting under a willow tree and watching the wind just cause the leaves to rise and fall and rise and fall. And there's this lovely, whimsical line that says, "Suddenly I realize that I'm happy. This feeling has been approaching now. This feeling has been approaching for months now, like a timid suitor." It's beautiful. So gentle, but really wonderful. So you have an incredibly rich poetic, contemporary poetic tradition in the United States that I'm a bit jealous of. So those are some of the ones that I love. And Rumi, the 12th century poet, he was teacher of Sharia law, and he has this lovely poem called Like This, written in Persian, translated into English. And one of the lines is, "If you ask me how did Jesus raise people from the dead, I will kiss you on the lips and say, like this." So he's really worthwhile reading. So why go outside? Soak yourself in God. He's beautiful. Yeah. Really, really worthwhile reading. So anybody else with questions? I can be a bit shorter in the answers too, if you're mildly intimidated by me holding your gaze for 5 minutes while I'm talking. Yeah. So can I talk about how Catholicism and the liturgical tradition comes into the poetry? I think from the point of view of most of the beginning of the energies of my life, I'm a rejected priest. I grew up with a deeply strong vocation to be a priest, which was divorced from me, not by my own desire. And so I suppose in some ways I'm trying to create sacrament through the power of words and temporary sacraments through that. And I suppose being part of a liturgical tradition that has respect for repetition and the respect for the year and the seasons of the year, that's really important. I feel no more liturgical than when I'm trying to arrange the order of poems for a book, and I try to do that in a way. The first book is called Readings from the Book of Exile, and I'd written a poem for a dear, dear friend, fascinating guy. And one time Phil is his name, and one time somebody said to me, "Is Phil a Christian?" And I just thought, oh my God, what a stupid question, because the idea that yes or no would do the integrity to anybody's life is an insult. And so I wrote the poem Readings from the Book of Exile for him as a response to that question that was trying to have a didactic, and I thought, well, the answer is in a poem. And so that poem has 7 small chapters. Some of the chapters are only a sentence long. And I structured Readings from the Book of Exile around each of those chapters. So there's one chapter called A Reading from the Book of Exile, the Unwritable Chapter, because the place of pain is the place of survival, and sometimes barely that. And that section is all poems about grief. So for me, there's a liturgical setting within that. And I suppose liturgy tries to make a certain kind of meaning without trying to colonize things and saying it's all going to be perfect. Absolutely fine. Liturgy is not about that. Liturgy is trying to create a certain amount of predictability in what is unpredictable, but not by trying to say it'll all be fine, because it really mightn't. And liturgy needs to be safe to people, for people to come when things aren't fine. Liturgy can't reject people for whom the ground has opened up. And so I suppose while I have a deep love for community and a deep love for hope, I never feel like you should end in a way that only makes sense for the people for whom life has worked out. So that for me is where liturgy should go. But that there should be a sense of vocation and the and meaning. And I suppose I see meaning in community and meaning in the possibility of naming some things and keeping other things quiet like that. I have a real love for Mary, and I think Mary is a remarkable character that is often overlooked and needs to have a lot of attention paid for. I used to think it's a real shame that in the Christian tradition there isn't a shared image for the incarnation. When I was doing my undergrad in theology, I had to write an exam once on are we shaved by, that would be an entirely different theological endeavor. Are we saved by the incarnation, by the life, by the crucifixion, by the death, by the descent into hell, by the resurrection, or by Pentecost? And it was a question of emphasis. It wasn't a question of supremacy of one over the other, but a question of choose one and argue for why that's your emphasis. And I chose the incarnation because I think there's something really interesting about the body. And especially in an area of conflict, we have to reckon with the body. And I was thinking, it's a real shame there isn't a shared symbol for the incarnation. But within Catholicism, that's what Madonna and Child always is. It's less about Mary, and it's more about saying God was born in the body of this little human and needed to be washed and dried and taught to speak. And so images of Mary with Jesus have nothing really to do with Mary as an individual and have everything to do with humanity was the parish into which God went. You know those lovely collections of best American short stories that come out each year? I think in 2007, the first line was, there are only two stories. A person went on a journey and a stranger came to town. Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous first line to anything. And I think the story of the Gospels is in a certain sense both. God going on a journey and the stranger coming to town in the person of an unknown child. And I love the image of Mary and Jesus for that because it's the image of both. Person going, like you can imagine this young girl going, what on earth is this person? And also this emerging consciousness of this child learning to speak who's on a journey himself. So I suppose that really informs my liturgical vision about what it means to be human and how we tell stories and why stories are important. I suppose I see stories as Eucharist that bind us together. Okay, and so from the age of 18 to 32, I worked with mostly evangelical organization and was regularly in a situation where people, like one time I was in France and somebody said to me, is there a Satanist symbol on the Catholic Eucharist? And the word no isn't meaningful enough to respond to that. Like, you just kind of go, how do I answer this? So I suppose I was constantly in the situation over lunchtimes and dinners and walking places, answering the question of, are you really a Christian? And I suppose it began to teach me that there is a question and there is the presumption of the question. And part of the presumption of that question is, really it's saying, are you like me? Because I know me and I'm okay. And I need to check, are you enough like me that I can think that you're okay? So fundamentally, there's a question about how do we relate to difference behind that. So I started to get really interested in both the theological answers and then also the underlying human connections. And sometimes I used to say to people, like they might hear on day one, I was running courses and people would work on come for 6 months, they might hear on day one, your man's a Catholic, still. And so somebody would come and go, how do you understand purgatory? And the tone would be reasonably, not aggressive, that's too strong a word, but didactic. And so I used to say, well, sure, let's get to know each other and we're going to be living together for 6 months, so we'll talk in a month, you know. Let's get to like each other so that we're not trying to judge will we or won't we be close based as to whether I use the right words to fit whatever agenda you have. So I suppose there's the content and content's important and there's the underlying human dynamic as well. So by the time I got to Belfast 10 years ago, I suppose I was very used to simply within the context of differences, ideological, theological differences, thinking, attending to the detail, and the details are important, but also attending to the underlying motif. I was also broke most of my life, and so I used to write poetry for friends for their birthdays and Christmas because I couldn't afford to buy them anything else. So I was used to trying to think, what's a hermeneutic into somebody's life that says something about them? So one time there was a friend who was walking along and there was a tree branch, and it wasn't a heavy branch. And instead of moving it, he stooped under it. And that said everything about him in that moment. And so there's a poem about him called "He Stoopeth Low, the Stupid Man." I don't think he liked it, but I loved the poem. I was really proud of it. So I suppose the idea of using words and not only attending to the detail, but attending to the underlying human dynamic had come through theological studies. I started a pontifical degree at the time. But also then through human dynamic of living in community with people who were very, very different and thinking that there's nothing to be frightened of in asking a question, provided I can ask it well and be open to hearing the answer. And name it without hiding an agenda. There is always agendas, but if I'm deliberately hiding an agenda, well, then I need to be courageous enough to state my agenda. So I moved to Belfast to work with this same organization, mostly evangelicals, that were wishing to make inroads in the Catholic community. And so I came as a Catholic to help people begin to learn the language of dialogue. Because if you go up to a Catholic in Ireland and say, "Are you a Christian?" they're going to understand, "Are you an evangelical Protestant?" And so they're going to, "I don't know what you mean," or "When did you become a Christian?" or different things like that. So you need to find a way to ask, well, what do we actually mean? And am I trying to colonize somebody into my way of thinking by asking them a question that feels hostile and using language that works for me but excludes somebody else? So it's a close attention to language, but really it's underneath that, it's a close attention to the structures of belonging that we create through language, and particularly the structures of exclusion. Trying to apply that within the context where people have lost members of their family, where people have taken up arms and shot those guns and taken a life or murdered a person or been part of a war, well, however they describe it, challenge those skills more than I ever have imagined in my life. And part of it is getting it wrong. And knowing how to say, okay, we've just encountered the limitation of words. And being able to name that in the moment and say, and there's great pain that's just been created through the words that I've used. And what do we do now? So I suppose I'm a snob when it comes to words. Not because I have a particularly erudite grammar, but because I really think we should search for the right words. And all kinds of people, whatever the level of education, know the right words for something that's very important to them. Is there a question here?
There's been brief mentions of your work with LGBT communities. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Okay. So the reason I'm not a priest is because in 2005... Pope Benedict made policy, a policy that said that no man of the homosexual tendency would be admissible for priesthood. And tendency was defined as something 2 years or more. I'm not sure who decided 2 years and 2 years in a day. Ah, you're out. Anyway, I was training at that stage, but so the bishop came and said, "You're out, you're gone." So I love my faith more than I'm able to say. I've tried deliberately at times to not love my faith, and it doesn't work. I'm haunted by it. And I love the Gospels more than I ever imagined I would. And so I do think that the Gospels possess something for us in terms of how to disagree really, really well. So part of my work, and it's where poetry, theology, and human dynamics and groups of conflict come together, where I host residential settings where people who represent different ideological viewpoints come together and we say we're going to have a conversation like you've never had before, because this isn't about an issue. This is about holding the gaze of an individual who represents the thing that we think we're going to talk about and talk to them and see if your words work or not. And let's apply the ethic of the gospel. So I wrote my master's thesis on a narrative analysis of Jesus' interactions with the marginalized characters in the Gospel of Mark. And the gospel is great news because it doesn't play into the idea of, well, you need to be in the right group, and if you're in the wrong group, you're screwed. It plays into the idea of, who do you exclude? The story of the Good Samaritan, for instance, is introduced by the idea of a lawyer comes to test Jesus. That's how Luke describes it. And he says to them, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Beautiful metaphysical speculation. Nothing at all to do with reality. And Jesus answers a beautifully Jewish answer. "You know the Torah. How do you read it?" Exegesis and hermeneutic. And then the man goes, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, your neighbor, yourself." And Jesus goes, "Well done." And so he's tricked the trickster into answering his own trick question. And then it says, but the man was anxious to justify himself. And so it shows us that often questions to do with hierarchy of belonging and exclusion and do you fit my idea are less to do with the reality and more to do with justifying yourself. And Jesus tells it, and he goes, who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, which I'm not particularly interested in, go and help the person beside the road. That's grand, but that's nothing new. What's much more interesting is, what is it like to be helped by somebody from whom you do not wish to receive help? Gollum, when Gandalf sends him to the woods to be helped by the elves, says, they hurts us with their nasty eyes. Gollum couldn't accept help from people who he considered his enemy because it hurt him. Because you have to fundamentally review your narrative of yourself when you are indebted to somebody who you fundamentally reject. And that is what I think is interesting about the gospel. And that's why it's bloody good news. So that's the work I do. I'm doing a PhD at the moment called What Were You Arguing About Along the Way? Which is a practical theology investigation as to if we have a social hermeneutic and an interpersonal hermeneutic for how we read the text, does that change the ground upon which we have this argument? My life isn't an argument, much more important than that, as is everybody's. And I'm not interested in insulting those who insult me either. So, for instance, I was at an event where somebody, 300 people, it was a public debate, and I made the philosophical argument that if there's love between two consenting adults who are not deceiving anybody, we need to ask ourselves the question as to the source of that love. It's a philosophical point. There is no love outside God. Any Episcopalians will know, God, you are the source of all things good and of your own we give you. And the man who was arguing against me said, and I mentioned my partner was in the crowd, and the man who was arguing against me said, what you call love is nothing better than incest. And it was a game. Because he wanted me to use lovely words that Irish people, and me included, are brilliant at, that rhymed with truck and off. And if I did, he would have won. So I said, I cook a damn good curry, and I'd like to invite you to my home, so we can talk. And he came, and it was fantastic. And that's the gospel. His mind didn't change, but our orientation towards each other was fundamentally all altered through that. So, one more question.
No? You talked a little about dialects and everything. I'm curious about the divisions of religion.
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, very few Protestant people would speak Irish anyway, so it's only Catholics really would tend to learn it. These are generalizations, of course, but in general. And there's four original provinces of Ireland, Munster, Ulster, Leinster, and Connacht. And the jurisdiction now known as Northern Ireland is two-thirds of Ulster. And Ulster is very close to Scotland, really. At the closest point, it's only 14 miles apart. So the Gaelic language, Scots Gaelic, spoken in the western parts of Scotland, and the dialect of Irish spoken in Ulster share a huge amount in common. So if I was to say, I'm not going, I'd say Níl Mhic Dul. But in Ulster, they'd say Chan Mhic Dul, Chan, C-H-A-N. And that's also what they say in Scotland, those who speak Scots Gaelic. So there's always been a level of exchange back and forth and between Scotland, Gaelic-speaking people in Scotland, and Gaelic or Irish-speaking people in Ulster. So some of the linguistic borderlands are also borderlands upon which divided territory was marked out. So it's an interesting question that you ask. I have given you the sum total of my knowledge about that. So I know that sounded great, but that's all I have. So.
I was wondering if there are any sort of shortish, not epic length Irish poems, and if you knew one, if you could read.
In Irish? In the Irish language, you mean? Oh, God. I read one earlier on. I wonder where my phone is. It might be in my pocket. I can read it to you. There's one really interesting one that I read earlier on. I turned my phone off. Hang on, let it power up. I'll find one for you. I'm going to finish with two poems. So I'll read one while this is powering up. I'll read an Irish poem and then finish with the final one of my own. This book, Sorry for Your Troubles, the poems, the titles of the poems have spaces between the letters deliberately, because I am very reluctant to title a story that's still living for individuals. And it was a real honor to be invited into the intimacy of individuals' trauma to hear stories of survival. And the stories were really remarkable. And they continue to be through that work. And so all the poems have spaces between the titles, so that there's space for the midrash of ordinary lives to happen in between those. And the first poem is called "The Word Became Stretched and Crept Among Us." And the poem says this: "It is the tense vocation of language to contain and constrain meaning. Some words are better than others. Alas, sounds nothing like keening. Some words deepen another. To be troubled is to be found bereaving. It is the tense vocation of language to contain and constrain meaning." Now let's see if I can get a line. Actually, does somebody have internet in their phone? On a kind of a smartphone that I'll be able to read from. It'll be faster, I think, because it'll take me a while to get online here. You do? Okay, so I'll read in English first and then read in Irish. So it's a poem. Oh gosh, can I see it? Ah, yeah, great. It's a poem called We Saw a Vision, and it's a poem in honour of the people who gave their lives for Irish independence. And Queen Elizabeth II visited Ireland a couple of years ago for the first time since Irish independence. And the first thing she did upon landing was to be taken to the Garden of Remembrance with Mary McAleese, who was the Irish president at the time. And they laid a wreath at the Garden of Remembrance and bowed while this poem was read. And it was remarkable. It was really stunning to watch the representative head of the monarch that had made the language illegal during the 19th century bow and listen to a poem read in English and Irish that remembered those who died to give their lives for Ireland and to give our lives for and indigenous independence. The next night, Queen Elizabeth stood up to address a state dinner and started off in Irish. She said, "O Uchtrán agus a Chairde, President and friends." That's the formal and informal way to speak to a gathered group of people. And I cried watching it in Belfast, because I thought, here is a woman who is the representative head of a country whose involvement in our country has been complicated. And she is speaking our language. And I thought, as a gesture is not the final word, but it's a damn good first word. And it was a stunning gesture that she offered. So here's the poem. We saw a vision. In the darkness of despair, we saw a vision. We lit the light of hope, and it was not extinguished. In the desert of discouragement, we saw a vision. We planted the tree of valor, and it blossomed. In the winter of bondage, we saw a vision. We melted the snow of lethargy, and a river of resurrection flowed from it. We sent our vision a swim like a swan on the river. The vision became reality. Winter became summer. Bondage became freedom. And this we left to you as our inheritance. Oh, generations of freedom, remember us, the generations of the vision. An Aisling. In Nurchlocht an Eadochus Rinna Ashlin Duan. Lassimer Solus and Dochus Agus Nirvuche.
Ivasak an lag vishnig rinna ashlinduan. Chirmer crown krogacha agus hanig bla air. Ingera na dirsha rinna ashlinduan. Vailmer schnakta taiva agus re awan na havyochna as. Chirmer ar nashling air snav mar ala eran awan. Rinna fearana den ashling. Rinna saura den gira. Rinna sira den dirsha agus dagam rugifsha mar airachthi. Aglonta na sirsha, kuinigi orna, glonta na hashlinga.
The fellow who read that, I was telling this to Casey last night, the soldier who read that, clearly was a man who, you know, does great things, but he read it like, Ingira na dirsha, durga din. We set a swan upon a river, and it sailed. Oh, for God's sake. Like all the preparation that went into this astonishing interstate activity, and they couldn't choose some eejit who had any sensibility of poetry. But that possibly was just projection. I don't know. So I started off by talking about the complication of living in a place where there are very few solidities, where there is few facts. Where do we live? Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland. Are we Irish? Are we British? Are we Northern Irish? Are we in the United Kingdom? Or where are we? What's our flag? Is there a flag? What do flags mean? All of these things. What's your name? How do I judge you according to your name? Do I say people, was it a war? Was it a terrorist activity? We have no shared narratives. So I have a poem called The Facts of Life, which is reflecting on relationship with facts and what some facts might be. And you're very good on a Monday night to sit and listen to 80 minutes of poetry. So I suppose I want to offer this to you as a blessing and as a hope for kindness in the way we live with each other, especially in the way we live with each other when shelter threatens to become shadow and when the possibility of human engagement across difference feels threatened by our fear of fear. And I hope for courage for you as in your studies and hope for the kind of courage that can make human community flourish as you bring yourselves to these endeavors. So I offer it to you in great thanks, and we'll hang around in a while and have a chat. So come up and tell me something interesting and then I'll remember you. So it's a challenge. The facts of life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie, if only to yourself. That you will get tired. That you will learn most from the situations you did not choose. There will be some things that move you more than you can say. That you will live. That you must be loved. That you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention. That you began as a fusion of a sperm and an egg from two people who once were strangers and may well still be. That life isn't fair. That life is sometimes good and sometimes even better than good. That life is often not so good. That life is real. And if you can survive it well, with love and art and meaning given where meaning is scarce. That you will learn to live with regret. That you will learn to live with respect. That the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constricting. That you will probably be okay. That you must accept change before you die, but you'll die anyway. So you might as well live, and you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. Mila Mahagav.